This is Our Anxiety Stories, the Anxiety Canada podcast. This is the place where people from all walks of life share their stories of anxiety and related disorders to remind you that you are not alone. If you have an anxiety story you'd like to share, contact us at anxietycanada.com/Our Anxiety Stories.
Hi, I'm your host, Mark Antrek, RCC and clinical educator, and you're listening to Anxiety Canada's Our Anxiety Stories podcast, the OCD series. Each week, we'll dive into personal stories, expert insights, and practical tips to help you understand and manage OCD. Whether you or someone you love is affected by OCD, this podcast aims to provide support, education, and a sense of community. Join us as we navigate this journey together, one podcast at a time. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Marlene Taub-Schiff, and she's been a registered psychologist for almost 20 years. Her clinical work specializes in treating primarily adolescents and adults with OCD, anxiety disorders, and trauma. She is the director and founder of Forward Thinking Psychological Services, a multidisciplinary practice operating in Ontario and British Columbia, focused on the treatment of OCD and OCD-related disorders. Dr. Taub-Schiff also co-founded the Sunnybrook Intensive Services Program for OCD, Canada's first residential treatment program in Canada for individuals with OCD. Additionally, she is the president of the Ontario Psychological Association and a member of Anxiety Canada's Scientific Advisory Committee. Marlene, thanks so much for coming today.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark. It's very exciting to be here.
You've been treating OCD for quite a number of years. I'd love to start by kind of asking what drew you to that particular specialization or to that particular population?
That's actually a great question. I guess one of the first times that I worked with individuals with OCD probably was during my residency. I was lucky enough to be at St. Joe's in Hamilton, Ontario. And I worked with Dr. Karen Roa and Dr. Randy McCabe, Dr. Marty Anthony, Dr. Peter Vieling. And OCD was one of the presenting issues that some of our clients had. And my very first group was actually with Dr. Karen Roa. So I got to learn from her. I think individuals with OCD, although it's like one presenting issue, if you will, it has such a heterogeneity to it that you could see two people that have sort of a similar presentation at the outset, but actually have a very different experience of the illness. So I have found that to be like very, very interesting to try to be able to help people in different ways for different issues that they have. Certainly my time at Sunnybrook was extremely formative in terms of my desire to continue to work with individuals with OCD. That was a wonderful time for sure to be able to work with other people and create kind of like the first residential program that we have in Canada. And I've always been drawn to working with individuals who have been experiencing psychiatric issues for many years and are struggling. I just really want to be able to help them in any way that I can with kind of the evidence-based approaches that we have. It's, you know, as you know, it's not always correctly diagnosed. It's not always correctly treated. I really find now in my career, in addition to doing clinical work, I'm engaged in teaching and supervision, just to really know that the dissemination of work that's getting out, sorry, the dissemination of treatment that's getting out is appropriate for individuals.
Absolutely. That's always a perspective that I've shared, that notion that you can have two folks that present in such similar ways, but have such distinct, unique features at the same time. And really going after that acknowledgement too, that so many clinicians will, on Psychology Today say that they treat OCD when they have very minimal training in OCD treatment, which is in large part why I think being able to educate and be able to talk about the unique components are so important here.
Agreed, 100%.
I also had no idea you were from Hamilton. That's where I was born. That's so funny.
Oh, it was just where I did my residency, actually. So I have I was born in Toronto.
Fair.
But I did spend a year in Hamilton. It was great. Absolutely. St. Joe's, I can't say enough good things. That could be another podcast. It was so awesome.
Truly. So, I bet.
Yeah.
I bet.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we start with just kind of some of the basics? This is our very first podcast in this series. Just really kind of helping us understand the foundations of what is OCD. So for those that are listening and they may not have a lot of background in it, how would you describe what OCD is or what some of the main symptoms or criteria are for it?
Yeah, for sure. It's a great question. So, individuals with OCD often will experience both obsessions and compulsions. When we think about obsessions, we talk about this idea of a person experiencing recurrent thoughts that are often very persistent. They can be urges, images, and they really are experienced with a sense of being intrusive and a sense of being distressful to the person that's experiencing them, which can cause a lot of anxiety as well as other emotions. And we can talk about that. So sometimes we think about there's just generally a lot of distress in response to having those kinds of thoughts. As a result of having those thoughts, as we can imagine, as we all do experience intrusive thoughts, which is something you and I can talk about too, people will try to ignore or maybe suppress those thoughts or urges or images, depending on how impactful and intrusive they feel. So then, in response to having those thoughts or urges or images, people will develop compulsions, which are repetitive behaviors. They can be overt, so something you and I could see someone doing. They could also be internal, so they could be mental acts that someone might be doing, really without anyone else's awareness. I think people become very skilled, if you will, at being able to carry out those compulsions without people noticing.
Very automated too.
Very automated, yeah. Like if you see someone who's been experiencing these types of things for decades, the way in which it happens is so habitual that sometimes it's difficult to interrupt those processes, right? So,
Absolutely.
I think the internal acts, if you will, can sometimes even be, I wouldn't say harder to treat. I don't like to compare different presentations because I think everyone is experiencing distress and discomfort within their own OCD story, if that makes sense. So, I think sometimes people feel, well, my OCD is somehow worse or this might be harder to treat. And I'm like, no, I have the same tools in my toolbox that I can offer you. And your experience of your experience is difficult, period, right? So I do think about that a lot. And I think compulsions, when they happen, people will understandably engage in them because it feels like in the moment it can prevent or reduce that anxiety or distress. All behavior is motivated and serves a purpose. So it's not wrong that someone would engage in compulsions by any means. It's something that has served them, often short term, to allow them to feel better. Would you want more around that? Or I don't know if you had any thoughts around
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. Like even just kind of really hammering that point home that compulsions, the way that I'll often explain it to my own clients is it is serving a function. It is the most natural reaction in the world. You have a lot of distress and you do X, whatever compulsion may be, to alleviate a lot of that anxiety, right?
For
Absolutely.
sure.
And as far as like any specific kind of unique presentations of OCD, anything you'd like to add about any of the other kind of symptoms that show up with that?
So, I think when we think about the ways in which OCD can present, bottom line, I find is that it can be about anything and everything under the sun, which makes it very difficult for people because there are areas, if you will, of OCD or the domains of OCD that can arise, often latch on to things that are very important to the person and that we think of are of value to them or meaning, if you will, right? I guess some common, if you will, presentations of OCD, they can latch onto areas of sort of contamination. Contamination, though, can be contamination obsessions where we might think about germs or dirt or sort of feeling kind of contaminated, and sort of cleaning compulsions could arise out of result of that. Contamination, though, we all also talk about emotional contamination where I'm sitting in a chair right now. and I have a bad thought, what feels like a bad thought to me. So now this chair has become contaminated. Or maybe I'm in a restaurant and something like that happens. So now this restaurant becomes contaminated. Or the food that I ate when I had the thought becomes contaminated. So sometimes we talk to our clients about this idea of magical thinking, where our thoughts start to take on associations that don't necessarily have any basis in the direct evidence that we have in the moment, right?
That's right.
OCD can also kind of latch onto areas of symmetry, if you will, ordering, repeating, counting. Taboo types of thoughts can be a very distressing type of OCD presentation for individuals, where we think about someone that experiences intrusive, aggressive thoughts, sexual related thoughts, religious obsessions and compulsions. And I think harm related thoughts are also very, they're all distressing, but those can all often be very distressing and sometimes even hard to tell someone about, like even a therapist or a trusted loved one, right? Because it's that idea, like, what would someone think of me if they knew that I was experiencing thoughts such as these?
I have a query about that because I'm curious how you navigate this piece, or what kind of advice you'd give around this. We know that especially a lot of those kind of taboo-oriented thoughts are often so scary for some folks to admit or talk about, because sometimes it feels like it falls within those limits of confidentiality, right? If you talk to any therapist and they kind of go through their initial spiel in that intake, they'll say, "We will not tell anyone about any of this unless it could be hurting someone, hurting yourself, if a minor's involved, or if there's a vulnerable population being affected." And I'm curious how or what kind of advice you might be able to offer folks if they're trying to figure out, can I talk to someone about this? Is it safe to make that distinction? Oh, like this is OCD.
Such a great question. I mean, we don't want to confuse thoughts with actions, if you will, that maybe people have engaged in when we think about like some of the, taboo situations, not thoughts themselves, but actions that people might carry out that sort of start to fall outside of OCD, if you will. A researcher from Canada who sadly passed away, Dr. Jack Rackman, certainly did wonderful pioneering work in illuminating the idea that we all actually have these types of intrusive thoughts. And that's part of psychoeducation for sure that I talk to people that I see about. So, I've had taboo thoughts. Probably Mark, you've had taboo thoughts.
Absolutely,
We
absolutely.
all do, and that's okay. And we can talk a little bit more about what that means to people when they have them. But that normalizing piece, I think, is important. Like, nobody goes to jail for thoughts alone, if you will. Someone once said that. That's certainly not my line. But I think it's also really important. Like, I could have a thought that I really hate someone and I wish I could punch them in the face, but I'm not going to do it. And I think what happens is people have these thoughts and they feel so real because they're your thoughts and lots of things that we think we actually end up doing. So it's like how we can help people to understand that sometimes thoughts are just thoughts. They're just kind of, neurons firing in our brain. The same thought of like the sun is out and it's a beautiful day, that's actually just a thought too. It's a much more pleasant thought to have. But I think helping people to see that it's okay to talk about your thoughts. Thoughts are just thoughts. Thoughts are not fact. How do we start to make sense of that together? And it's often, I think, because what the thoughts mean to that person when they have them.
Right. And therein lies the appraisal model, right? In the treatment of OCD, which is how we make meaning of our thoughts, and really just kind of hammering that point home. Every single person experiences intrusive thoughts. No one is immune to intrusive thoughts, but how someone reacts to it or how someone makes meaning from it is what's going to make or break OCD developing or it being kept at bay.
So, like a great example that I've shared with clients before is, sometimes when I've come to an intersection and people are walking, I'll have an intrusive thought, like, what would happen if I just kept going, you know? So in an appraisal model, we sort of think about, okay, well, what does that thought mean to me? Well, like to me, it means that's a weird thought, you know, like that's strange. It doesn't really fit with who I am. Doesn't, I guess that's just a thought and it kind of floats away, right? But then we could have an individual who has OCD who has that thought and then starts to think like, I must be a really bad person for having a thought like that. Oh wow, there was a mother pushing a baby carriage by. Like I must be a terrible person. I must be a terrible parent, even if I'm thinking that I could harm someone else's child. And it goes down what we call almost like the rabbit hole, right? Of appraisal and trying to find meaning in something that my guess is has no meaning at all, right? Not to minimize it, but that person is probably just like you and me and wouldn't actually drive through that intersection. But then when we start to go down that rabbit hole, that thought is given a lot of power and attention and weight, and it starts to become more important than the other person that had that thought, that it just kind of weird thought and it kind of floats away, right? So,
Right.
yeah.
Like that notion or that thought, internal dialogue, there must be a reason why I'm having that thought. They're like, why
Exactly.
am I thinking this? Does that mean that I'm a danger to people? Does that mean I'm a dangerous person? Which we could very much appreciate when we start to have that kind of internal dialogue and we start to actually think we're dangerous. We want to do something to try and prevent something bad from happening, ergo
Exactly.
compulsions.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what can happen.
Would you mind speaking on a little bit about what thought action fusion is? Because that's a unique proponent of OCD that relates to this piece here
Right.
as well.
Yeah, so it's often this idea that I've had this thought and that must mean something about me. It must mean that I am more likely to carry out that behavior than if I never had the thought at all. So if you're, I don't know, walking around and you're in a park and you see kids and somehow you have a thought that that child is cute or attractive or you know something, and then all of a sudden it's like, I'm an adult. Why am I having thoughts about children? What does this mean? Mean that I'm more likely to carry that out, that action. I'm more likely to engage in this than if I'd never had the thought at all. Right? So it's like having the thought in and of itself suggests that you're more likely to kind of engage in that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And I've had some folks also describe like obsessions as urges. They almost feel like they are
Right.
urges. Can you
Yes.
speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, so I guess when we talk about maybe some of the sexual intrusive thoughts, we could get into that a little bit where people talk about what we call a groinal response, which is again a very normal part of our physiology that sometimes happens in response to things that we find attractive and sometimes just happens, frankly, because we're human beings kind of navigating the world. Even sometimes anxiety can kind of feel a little bit, I mean, anxiety is arousing, right? So when people talk about that, it's like, well, I saw a picture of this and then I scanned my body and I had this groinal response. Wow, that must mean that I'm either attracted to the person in that picture or I'm attracted to a child or some kind of sexual intrusive thought that doesn't feel like what the person typically wants to engage in, if you will. But because they had the thought and they scanned and they noticed the groinal response, it's like, wow, this must actually mean something. And now I have to do a whole bunch of things, my rituals, in order to neutralize the thought, avoid looking at pictures like that, not go into areas where this kind of a person might be or children might be populating. So yeah, I think again it's like hypervigilant scanning and then a misinterpretation, if you will, of what we want to help the person to see is it's okay, that can happen. You know, you can have a groinal response and it doesn't necessarily mean that anything like that might happen. And it's sort of tolerating these physical sensations, if you will, as being part of our repertoire of kind of being human and navigating the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely makes sense. And just even kind of following that idea, whether it's within the realm of sexual taboo thoughts or whether it's just harm and safety, this idea that you having a thought doesn't mean that you're actively suppressing an urge. Because
Absolutely.
an urge at the end of the day is you trying to fight a desire to do something, whereas obsessions are often you worrying that you might do something, right?
Yes, exactly, Mark.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
Really, really important distinctions I think to make here, because truly this is where a lot of that nuance comes in. And I guess this is where perhaps the next question can come in, where we talk a little bit about what the difference is between OCD and anxiety. Obviously, a lot of overlap between the two, but how would you describe kind of like what anxiety is and just some of the unique proponents of that one?
It's a great question. And I mean, anxiety and OCD used to be a bit more lumped together, if you will, in terms of clinicians used to think of the diagnostic categories. But now OCD sort of has its own chapter, if you will, in a book that many psychologists, psychiatrists, other practitioners will use. Anxiety can be present in OCD. I mean, anxiety in and of itself is a natural emotion that we all need to experience. I always tell people, I can't get rid of your anxiety. I wouldn't want to get rid of your happiness. So in the same way, like I can't get rid of that emotion of anxiety. Anxiety can be motivating. Anxiety can be protective when something is dangerous. So these are all, I would say anxiety is yet another important emotion that we all need to experience. And anxiety can exist within the context of OCD, but individuals with OCD can also experience emotions that are not just anxiety, if you will. So I think that can be really important. Like disgust, I find, is one of those emotions that individuals with OCD can have that, like someone with generalized anxiety disorder, another kind of psychiatric presentation, that would not exist. Disgust would not be sort of a feature within that kind of an anxiety disorder or social anxiety. So what's, I think, important sometimes about OCD is that's why we talk about this idea of distress, because distress encompasses anxiety, but it also encompasses other emotions as well. Sometimes people talk about guilt and shame and disgust, and we sort of think about these different kinds of emotions that can also emerge in response to these intrusive thoughts that you and I have been talking about.
Absolutely. And anxiety gets thrown around so much. That word is so commonplace these days. Would you be able to give like a really kind of basic definition of what anxiety is or how it's experienced?
Yeah, so I mean, I think anxiety is not, I'm not not clinical anxiety. I just mean anxiety in general is aversive. We don't like experiencing anxiety. I think there's if we sort of break it down, there's probably like physical and cognitive and kind of feelings that go along with anxiety. Physically, anxiety, we all kind of, I think, have our symptoms that we tend to experience within the context of anxiety, but we could be sweating, we could feel our heart rate increase, we might have difficulty breathing. I think those are, some hallmarks, difficulty swallowing. Like there's different things that people experience in the context of anxiety.
Those fight
Thoughts
or
can
flight based reactions, so to speak.
exactly fight or flight based. Thoughts can be, somewhat catastrophic in nature at times, like I can't do this, or something really bad is about to happen, or I can't handle this. There's a true feeling of discomfort that I think people then really try to avoid. I don't like to experience anxiety. I was a bit anxious before I came on to talk to you today. I don't love
Yeah,
it. It's not
absolutely.
like sign me up to experience anxiety. But we often talk about, well, if something of value to you and really meaningful, would you want to kind of take that anxiety with you so you can then carry out something that's of value and it's very important? It's almost like keeping it in tow. Like there are some situations where we can't necessarily go into without anxiety. I could not have shown up today and not felt an ounce of it. It just was impossible. It's, public speaking, it's a whole bunch of things, right? So I think it's also helping people to see that anxiety, albeit uncomfortable, is not dangerous in and of itself. Nothing bad is going to happen other than you'll feel uncomfortable, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And just kind of noting that at the end of the day, anxiety is a protective mechanism gone rogue, right? It's a thing
Exactly.
that we need. It's a thing that's hardwired into our evolution, into our genetics, but it's just doing such an incredibly good job that it's making us have this overinflated fear of things that we typically wouldn't be fearful of. The
Exactly.
metaphor I often give is kind of like an overactive fire alarm and the toaster, you know?
Yeah.
We want the toaster there to protect us. We want us, or not the toaster, we want the fire alarm to protect us. We want to make
Totally.
sure that it alerts us to fires, but not every single time we make toast, kind of thing.
Exactly. Because then it's misfiring all the time, right? So sometimes people are very sensitive to anxiety. This idea of anxiety sensitivity, which we know that individuals with anxiety disorders are bit more tuned in, you can just feel that more often. You just feel those symptoms, or you're scanning for those symptoms, you're more aware of them. Again, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do the things that you're going to experience anxiety during, but it is kind of learning that it's okay to experience that and still be able to do something that you really want to do. Yeah.
The line that I remember a mentor of mine once told me, when someone's really scared of doing something, tell them they can do it scared. Right?
Exactly. That's great.
It's not ideal. We ideally don't want
Right.
to be facing a feared scenario when we're sweating buckets or having like major heart palpitations. But it's not a matter of whether or not you can do it. It can be done. It's just a matter of whether you allow yourself to go through it and endure that distress during.
Exactly. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about some of like the physiology. So some of those fight or flight symptoms. We talked about some of
Yeah.
those thoughts that can show up. As far as like behaviors go, as far as the different manifestations of the reactions to anxiety, those I imagine link a lot to compulsion. So, what are some of the kind of typical, more broad reactions we could have to something that we fear or to anxiety in general?
Yeah, so anxiety in general, I always think of avoidance as such a big hallmark feature when we're thinking anxiety. That's kind of a whole shutdown where we typically, don't want to do it, all the things that can make us anxious. I mean, in response to anxiety, there can be lots of other things too, which can be part of OCD and can just be part of, I think, behaviors that can go along with anxiety. Checking to make sure that we did something right or the way we wanted to do it, I think can be a part of anxiety. Reassurance seeking can be a part of anxiety, which is basically checking with someone else to give you that extra boost that, like, yes, you did that, or yes, the lights are off, or yes, this email looks good before you're going to send it out, or checking on ourselves, did I read that correctly? Let me reread it again. So, anxiety, I think, can push those kinds of behaviors where we're not necessarily believing in our actions, right? Trying to gain some kind of external, I guess, reinforcement that things are the way we need them to be. Otherwise, we might continue to feel that sense of anxiety.
Right. So
Yeah.
pretty much anything that we do to give ourselves like a sense of reassurance, to try and achieve
Sure.
a sense of certainty, basically something that we do that makes the bad feeling go away from the sounds of
Exactly.
it.
Yeah,
Yeah.
exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, we've kind of talked about the two separate components. We know OCD has some unique elements. We know OC or anxiety more broadly has some overlapping tendencies. Can you talk a little bit about where OCD and anxiety more specifically overlap, or perhaps give a couple of examples on some anxiety disorders and how it could look very similar to OCD?
Yeah. So, one I always think about, because I find it can be in its real presentation, can sometimes be like, you're not sure. Generalized anxiety disorder and OCD share some features, So we just talked about like the reassurance seeking behavior. That's something we often can see in both of them. We talk about an intolerance of uncertainty, which can show up in both GAD and OCD. One of the best explanations I ever got for that was sort of like an allergy to uncertainty. Like it's hard to tolerate it, and you really want to know what you want to know. And I think those two presentations can have overlapping, ways in that sense, in terms of that intolerance of uncertainty. And I think obsessions sometimes can feel like worries, if you will. I mean, I think when we veer off into the idea of worries, we try to think a little bit more about sometimes beliefs that people have about worries. Sometimes people will have positive beliefs about worries. We may say they don't feel as intrusive. I think sometimes when someone's sitting with you, they might say it does feel really uncomfortable. Maybe not intrusive, but uncomfortable to have these excessive worries. So, as clinicians, when we work with people, we want to try to tease these things apart. Not that the distinctions necessarily are going to change everything that we do with someone. There certainly are overlaps in terms of our treatment, interactions, how we approach these things. But, from a conceptualization and being able to share that with the client in terms of like, this is more or less where we think these things are fitting into, because there can be some unique of treatment that we would build in.
Yeah, and that kind of just like reminds me about the age-old question, because I know this can be a pretty polarizing opinion or question in the clinical community, like the need for a diagnosis or the need to label something, right? Because on one hand, being able to have someone come into your office and they say, "Hey, I keep getting these intrusive thoughts about harming my child," and you say, "So here's what's actually happening. You have OCD. You have a form of harm and safety based OCD." The palpable relief, the tears that often come in those moments. It's such a powerful moment. But I also know that there's a lot of folks that come in and they are very determined to have a label. And, especially if they maybe don't just have OCD, maybe they have OCD, maybe some perfectionism, which we know could fit into OCD. Maybe they have health anxiety, what have you. Is it important to be able to label and put things into boxes? Is that
That's
required
such
to
a
be able
great
to get s
question.
support?
Yeah, so I mean, as a psychologist, of course, I'm able to diagnose, and that's one of the things that I do, and supervise others to be able to do and learn. It's interesting because I worked in the hospital system for so much of my career, and we would engage in more diagnosis because, I was fortunate to have psychiatrists on my team, so sometimes we would look into medication options. And when I began working in the community, I didn't think there would be as much of a want for that. But as you said really nicely, individuals do come in and they feel like, I've really experienced this compilation of symptoms. Like what's going on, And sometimes people will just come for that. And I think, wow, that's amazing that I'm able to help you kind of sift through all of this that you've been experiencing. And maybe in those occasions, hate to say label, but putting a bit of a label on it, or a bit of a name to it, if you will, I think can be very helpful. I think I naturally get diagnostic impressions, if that makes sense, as a psychologist, and I do use them to be able to conceptualize what's going on and share treatment recommendations. And I tell that to everyone I see. So I like to do a nice 90-minute session when I see someone for the first time, do what I call a thorough intake, which I always say might feel like a lot of questions that I'm throwing your way. But I said, I want to understand who you are with respect to OCD, but who you are with respect to all your other areas of functioning, right? And then put that all together and try to understand like what might be going on, diagnostically, what might be contributing to that. So I don't think it's the end all or be all. I would never ever say that. But I guess I've learned since I've been practicing how much it actually can be helpful for the person. And also just when we think about evidence-based treatment, like what would I think of pulling differently if I sort of understand what's going on a little bit differently too?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such an important piece, this idea that we, at the end of the day are trained to be able to approach to treat a variety of different symptoms. And we are based in the medical model, which is essentially rooted in here's your problem, let's figure out a way to address it. I'm very impressed that you're able to cut down your intake to an hour and a half. Mine is an hour and 50 minutes. And I pretty much just say, this is going to sound or feel like a giant interview because I just want to get a big sense of who you are and the
Great.
different ways that you present. But it just kind of sounds like it's walking that line of I need a
It
little
is.
bit of an idea to have some structure, to have a little bit of kind of guidance in how I approach this versus being open to the acknowledgement that this isn't always black and white. It doesn't always fit neatly into a box, and we need to have some flexibility with that.
Absolutely. And it's iterative too, right? So when I do assessments, I also feel like this is one moment in time. But my assessment, if you will, keeps going, right? Because you keep meeting with the person and you want to keep learning about them and understanding what's going on with them over time and to really be able to share that with the person too.
Yeah, absolutely. So speaking of like labeling and assessment, we know that OCD has kind of taken a more recent trend towards talking about subtypes. You go on any of the major OCD websites, you go on even like major ERP platforms, you are going to find people kind of categorizing the different subtype of OCD that they have. How can you speak to that a little bit and maybe like whether or not you think it's important or yeah.
I'm a little mixed. I mean, sometimes, like you said, it can be helpful for people to think about it. Certainly, when I first worked with OCD, it wasn't something that we talked about in the way we do now. I think that one of the risks, if you will, to subtyping is that someone might work on this one area of OCD and then hopefully feel better and maybe leave therapy. And then OCD has a really nasty habit of morphing and changing, sometimes developmentally, sometimes just with life and stressors. And then it feels like, well, this is a whole new area of OCD. Like, how do I now, transfer these skills that I've learned? So when I meet with people, and sometimes people come in and they would have, if we go by the subtype language, two or three or four subtypes, their OCD has latched into different domains. I always say that whatever we're going to work on, in one domain, we can transfer it to another domain. Or let's mix things up, if we're working on things in what we call like an exposure or response prevention hierarchy, we can mix stuff up. It doesn't have to be that we can only work on your harm-related OCD and then we have to move on to, your contamination-related OCD. So I think it has probably helped people in terms of understanding things. But there are also things that people will present with that aren't going to fall in the subtypes because, once again, OCD can be about anything and everything. So you might look for a subtype and then think, oh, this thought doesn't fall within a subtype. Does that mean something's wrong with me? Does that mean it's not OCD? So there's sort of a risk, I guess, if you will, and sometimes self-diagnosing or reading too deep into all the things that people have captured, which might not capture what the person is actually experiencing, which might very well be OCD that just a subtype has not been named as of yet, right?
Truly. And again, we have this natural tendency, I think, as clinicians, but also as humans, to create structure to label. I know even in my intake assessments, when I'm going through all the major kind of obsessions and trying to identify a bunch of them using the Y box, it's really tough when you have someone who says, I get these intrusive thoughts about being in hell if I take a left or a right at this fork in the road. But I also am convinced that if I take a left, it's going to result in this sexual taboo thing. And if I take the other direction, it's going to like just so many different unique presentations. That's kind of where the limits come in, I guess, right?
I think so. I do. I think there's so many unique presentations for sure.
Absolutely. So OCD, we've seen is popping up in the media a fair bit, and has been in the media, in like some pretty specific ways. You know, we have the individuals who just need to line things up perfectly, and we have like the folks that like clean things really perfectly, or the hand washing. We know that OCD often gets misused, to almost as a little bit of like a tropey, kind of component. Oh, I'm just a little bit OCD. Oh, I'm just OCD about this thing. You know, folks looking at their ingredients, the way that their fruit presents at the market. What are your thoughts on that? And what would you kind of say to those that use that flippantly or use it pretty often, that kind of languaging?
I think it's insulting, to be very honest, to the people that actually experience hours of their day being taken up by obsessions and compulsions. And I think, unfortunately, it becomes a bit stigmatizing too, right? I would never use that language for sure, because I think it doesn't honor the people that I work with in terms of what they're really experiencing. Can I use a public washroom and clean my hands a little bit more than if I'm in my home washroom? Yes. That's just within the range of typical behaviors that people do when they're in different situations, right? So, for an individual to truly, if you will, we're talking about diagnosis, but kind of reach that diagnostic threshold, it really is significant impairment in a number of areas, right? Where they're impacted in terms of relationships, in terms of social or occupational functioning, in terms of daily tasks of living. Right? If someone just engages in something that feels like you said, extra order, or like extra cleanliness, like we're not really touching on the depth, I think, that people do experience when they're actually presenting with a diagnosis of OCD. So it's unfortunate, I would argue. And perhaps, we really think about that lack of education and why something like this that we're doing and the focus on OCD through Anxiety Canada is so essential. So people really understand what it is and are validated in their own experiences.
I came across a couple weeks ago. My partner's a very big coffee guy, and he found this tool, I guess, it kind of flattens the grounds
I know
before
what you
you
mean.
pull a shot.
My
And there's
husband's a
an
big coffee guy
actual,
too.
right? Yeah. So they basically, I saw this tool that is meant to flatten these grounds, but it literally had like an allusion to OCD in it, where the company brand name was, I don't want to make a public call out here, but they were literally equating your grounds will be so perfectly flat that it links to OCD. And it's just one of those examples, right? Where in theory, you know, you see the folks in the boardroom kind of making that decision, and they're saying, this is a solid marketing strategy. This is really putting across that our tool is going to be really good at what it does. But then we think about the folks that we treat and just the challenges and the pain that they deal with every single day, to be compared to having your coffee grounds be perfectly dispersed. You know, it really just goes to show the discrepancy and the dissonance that happens there.
Agreed. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we've been talking a lot about OCD, anxiety, and one of the things that I think would be really helpful to also acknowledge in this conversation is the topic of personality disorders. Because I think it's a really common topic that's happening, especially online. You know, we have a lot of folks that are talking about borderline and narcissism, and those terms blatantly get misused a lot, similar to the term, you know, OCD as well. But can you tell us a little bit about what obsessive compulsive personality disorder is, and what that may look like to folks?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll call it OCPD for shorthand, if that sounds okay. It is different than OCD. Sometimes there's a co-occurrence. I think it's around 25%, maybe there can be a co-occurrence. But with OCPD, we really think more about this sort of preoccupation with orderliness, perfectionism, mental and interpersonal control. Really, at the expense of someone being able to be more flexible or open and not as rigid. And I, to be honest, I don't love the term personality disorder, and I really don't use it when I work with people. I talk about an interpersonal style, and or it's almost like a characterological trait, if you will. So it's like sort of built into a personality component. And I guess one thing just to highlight about OCPD is really we talk about this term, which is called egosyntonic, which means that it aligns with how we feel as a person. So when someone's engaging in some of these behaviors, it doesn't necessarily feel aversive. It often feels good and it feels consistent with who I want to be. Because it's an interpersonal style, it can often impact other people in their life. Whereas OCD, as we've talked about a lot, those intrusive thoughts, we call those egodystonic, which means that they don't feel like they align with who I really want to be as a person. And those are some important distinctions between the two. When someone presents with both, we do sometimes want to think about the personality piece and how that might impact our ability to sort of get at the OCD. That's probably a whole different podcasting conversation. But just wanted to note they are different, and hopefully I've highlighted like the differences enough for our listeners. It's not the same, and having OCD does not mean you would have OCPD, and having OCPD does not mean you would have OCD, although they can co-occur at times.
Right. And would you care to talk just briefly, like, what are some of like the main ways that you notice OCPD show up very, very often or like very frequently? Maybe some of the ways that other folks will have their relationships be impacted by it, because I know there's some pretty unique characteristics of that.
Yeah, so it can sometimes be a need for things to be done in a certain way, not necessarily because of an intrusive thought, just because you might like things to be organized in a certain way. I don't know for why this popped into my head, but I remember one sort of presentation, you know, the dishwasher needs to be organized very particularly. Plates need to be lined up in a certain way. It can be time consuming. If someone else tries to do that task within the family, it can sort of ignite, again, those interpersonal challenges, right? So, you know, I know that's a small example, but it's those kinds of things that can sort of show up, and people need to adhere to very specific, rigid kind of ways and rules that to the person don't necessarily feel problematic, but can feel problematic when other people are trying to live in that space.
That example is so comical to me because when we first got our dishwasher, I read how to most efficiently load it and what spots are going to lead to the best cleaning potential. And it's, you know, this is where that spectrum lies, right?
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Exactly.
I have a strong preference to how those things need to be put into the dishwasher. I will have a little moment with my partner if he does it otherwise, but it's not to a point of dysfunction or it's not
Right.
impairing my quality of life, as we've
The
talked about.
excessiveness of it in multiple tasks across different domains, of course, didn't want to minimize it or anything, just
No,
one little,
of course.
but yeah, absolutely.
So we are going to be having some episodes in the future that dive into a lot of different topics, but one of them is going to be talking about treatment in particular. We know that ERP, and this is kind of just like a bit of a preview appetite question. We know ERP is the gold standard. Everyone knows it as the gold standard, rather. That's the
Right.
one that everyone kind of talks about is absolutely necessary. Can
Right.
you speak to just like the range of different types of
Yeah.
therapies that can treat OCD and just give like a little brief description on like kind of the main ones that you might utilize?
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of the main ones I utilize, absolutely exposure and response prevention, ERP, as you alluded to, falls under the umbrella of cognitive behavioral therapy, which also can incorporate cognitive strategies, which we know can boost the effectiveness, looking at, you know, thought records, looking at other tools we can get at to help people with an overinflated sense of responsibility, and those kinds of issues that can emerge. So CBT, focus on ERP, is excellent for that. I also use, as it is evidence-based, acceptance and commitment therapy kind of infused into my ERP work, which often focuses on values-based approaches and helping an individual engage in exposure, which is very much a part of ACT. In terms of experientially kind of living things, experiencing things, not necessarily to acclimate to anxiety, but very much to engage in values-based moves and things that are aligned. Inhibitory learning is sort of a whole other approach, if you will, where we also sort of can bring that into our ERP, really helping the person replace old learning with new learning in terms of things that emerge during ERP, things that they learn, things that they might be surprised by. So having different reflections within the realm of ERP.
Sorry,
Another approach.
can you clarify that term just a little bit more specifically, inhibitory learning? Like,
Yes.
what's another way you can describe that?
So another way would be sort of inhibiting that old learning, which the old learning might be when I engage with this particular task, I get anxious or I want to avoid or I want to kind of shut down. And my new learning doing my exposure work might be recognizing that I can complete this process and I can laugh with my therapist or smile when I do this process and I make it to the other side. So it's this idea of how can we learn new things during our exposure work that can start to kind of replace, if you will, the old learning that has historically been there that has prevented us from engaging in those things.
So kind of like the disconfirmation model. So because I
Yeah.
practice all these compulsions, when I do X, it actually prevents Y from happening. Oh, well, it turns out if I don't do X, Y still doesn't happen.
Right.
Same kind of
Yeah.
idea.
Yeah, exactly. And then I guess just a quick nod to an approach, it's called inference-based CBT. Again, evidence-based, it's been around for quite a while. It comes out of Canada, from Montreal. So, and it's really, I think, kind of finding its place, very rightly so, within our landscape of being able to work with individuals with OCD. It is a different conceptualization. Obsessions are looked more at what we call obsessional doubts as opposed to intrusive thoughts. And we start to unravel a process that's called inferential confusion, which in a nutshell is about the narrative that our OCD can create and that we can so easily, if you will, step into because it feels so real. We often can sort of confuse, if you will, what's happening in reality with what our OCD has really created for us that feels so powerful in that moment. It's another kind of CBT, and it's helping individuals to kind of relearn, if you will, or unwind and relearn that narrative and ground themselves very firmly in reality using things such as five senses, common sense data, belief in what we call the real self. And it really helps individuals to gain back the confidence in making decisions for themselves, not what their OCD, if you will, is sort of suggesting that they do. So I use that a lot in my practice. I think it's excellent. I think it's also a wonderful approach. People have sometimes tried ERP and they're not where they want to be. So how amazing that we have more than one tool in our toolbox now. I think we're pretty lucky as clinicians to have that.
No, truly just even recognizing there is no one size fits all approach. You know,
Absolutely.
some folks could really resonate with one form of therapy. Sometimes we need a combination of different kinds of therapies.
Yes, exactly.
Inferential based cognitive therapy is, from the sounds of it, becoming very popular because it doesn't
Yes.
require you to kind of like white knuckle and go through the distress
Yes,
involved in exposure
exactly.
based intervention. So sounds like there's a lot of potential there.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Well, Marlene, we're just coming up to a close here. Any kind of final thoughts, any queries, any pieces that you'd like to share before we wrap up?
Not much, Mark. I just wanted to thank you again for having me. And it's really such a privilege to be able to talk to you and to, share this time with our listeners through Anxiety Canada. And I just hope so much that what we talked about today resonates with some of our folks and really allows for them to, I don't know, maybe reach out for help or learn a little bit more about what's been going on for them.
Absolutely. Really just reiterating that notion that you are not alone in this fight. You know, it could be such a debilitating illness, but at the end of the day, there are a lot of programs, a lot of resources, and a lot of wonderful professionals like Marlene here who have just been working with us so successfully. And both of us have just seen the really tremendous outcomes that can come from this. So hopefully hope is a word that comes out of today's first episode. So thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to have you back.
Yes, thanks. Absolutely. Anytime.
Thank you for listening to Our Anxiety Stories, the Anxiety Canada podcast. To share your own stories or to find resources and support this podcast, visit us at anxietycanada.com.